Hey everybody, it's Dr. Ray Heinisch, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Cut the Fat Podcast. Find out more information about us at www.cutthefatpodcast.com. Also, search for us on Facebook by just typing in Cut the Fat Podcast, all one word, and it'll pull us right up. And of course, be sure to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. All you got to do is search for weight loss or search for Cut the Fat Podcast, and it'll pull us right up there, and just hit the subscribe button. In today's episode, I get together with two friends and colleagues. You know them both. It's Dr. Jade Tito with The Metabolic Effect and Jonathan Baylor with The Smarter Science of Slim. And basically, we just kind of got together to have a fitness and fat loss nerd fest where we sit around and talk about fat loss and things that I think are important to the topic. In this episode, we got together to talk about exercise and fat loss. More specifically, the kinds of things that we do in our own lifestyle, as well as what impact exercise actually has on fat loss. What was interesting is that we all three have similar philosophies about exercise and how it impacts fat loss, and yet we all three have very different exercise programs. So listen to the episode, and then I'll meet you guys on the other side to give you my kind of parting thoughts on the subject. Now, I'll point out that we had intended to go through a whole lot more than we actually got through, but we just ran out of time. So we are going to meet up very soon to continue the conversation about the impact of exercise on your fat loss efforts. So enjoy, and I'll see you guys on the other side.
All right, you guys, I'm here with Jonathan Baylor of the Smarter Science of Slim and my man, Dr. Ray Heinisch from the Cut the Fat podcast. I'm really excited because these two guys are, you know, obviously they're good friends of mine. We always like to get together and do this, but they're also two brilliant guys. And so we just love to sort of touch base and go through questions. And this is really, you know, something that we do just to kind of get caught up on the latest research. And also we like to sort of, you know, kind of hear what our respective followers are sort of asking. So how you guys doing?
Oh, doing well. How about yourself?
Doing good, man. Doing good.
Doing well over here as well.
Good. Jonathan's over. Me and Ray are on the East Coast, and Jonathan, you're over there on the West Coast. So, but yeah, man, it's good to connect with you guys. You know, one of the first thing I wanted to do, if it's cool with you guys, is just kind of go through. You know, I always like to kind of get your insight on, you know, sort of what's going on, you know, in your world. What are your followers talking about? What are the big questions you're getting? That kind of stuff. So, Jonathan, you want to kind of fill us in on sort of any new stuff with you, any interesting research, client cases, et cetera?
Well, I'd say the two most fascinating recent research studies I've just been enamored with and my fans have been looking at is the research done with the, I think, Hazara tribe, if I'm describing it correctly, where they actually tested the hypothesis that our hunter-gatherer ancestors were more active than us. And the reason we are suffering from all of the obesity-related maladies we are today is because we're less active. And actually performing the first ever study to actually look at the amount of calories burnt by a modern hunter-gatherer tribe, and shockingly to find that, yeah, they're burning about the same number of calories we all are. So that's not the reason we're overweight. That, to me, is just incredible, because that just objectively proves that this dogma we've heard of, just if you'd just be more active, you'd be slim, it just throws it out the window.
Yeah, I thought that was really an interesting article as well. Go ahead, Ray.
I'm pretty sure that we all can say that exercise plays an important role on some level, but we have to figure out how does it fit into the program? What is the importance of it? Is it more important for maintenance? Is it important for fat loss? And exactly how to apply that in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you guys. I mean, to me, it's I think for our listeners, it's probably really confusing to me, because, you know, obviously they love the idea, you know, that, okay, I got something I can do, and exercise is usually that thing that they can do. And you know, the three of us know, I mean, it's like they would much rather be doing exercise, it seems, than really trying to control their diet. I mean, if you're going to have somebody, you know, really who wants to go on a plan, normally they choose over exercising first. And, you know, I continually see in the research lately, and actually just posted for you guys in the chat section of this, a article I just read actually today, ironically, that's basically came out August 1st. And basically what it looked at was the discrepancy between sort of the predicted and observed weight loss with exercise. You know, so basically if we have a group of people exercise for, you know, 30 minutes doing aerobic exercises versus 60 minutes a day, you know, the old model tells us that those people doing 60 minutes per day should burn, you know, twice the amount of calories, should lose twice the amount of fat. And what this study shows, as many have shown, is that that actually is not the case at all. This was a 13-week study, and one group did 30 minutes of exercise daily. The other group did 60 minutes of exercise daily. The calories were, you know, double in the group that did the 60 minutes, obviously, but the weight loss and fat loss was exactly the same. And so I think it speaks to what, you know, you're saying, Jonathan, and what Ray's saying. You know, there seems to be at least a, you know, part of a diminishing returns when it comes to exercise. And we need to sort of understand what is going on. Now, obviously, this is aerobic exercise, and a lot of the studies are aerobic exercise heavy and not so much focused on weight training. But I think this is huge and something that absolutely we need to be looking at. And I think part of it is, you know, that when you exercise, obviously it makes you hungry. So there's compensatory reactions. And I think what you're speaking about, Jonathan, too, in that particular study you're talking about is that these people didn't have resting energy expenditures. You know, the amount of calories that they burned at rest were no different than, you know, the average American today. And, you know, despite the movement that they do and despite the way they're living. So this stuff is definitely something that has come up with my followers as well. And it's, you know, it's a bit confusing. So.
Well, Jade, let me, and Ray, let me throw something out there and see what you guys think of it, because this is a little bit radical. Ray, I'll use your term here, which I love, is this vampire myth term. And I think there's, Jade, you just hit on that. There's this vampire myth that exercise is the antidote for eating low quality foods, and that it's almost like indulgences back in the Middle Ages, where you could sin, but if you went and paid the Catholic Church a certain amount of money, your sins would be forgiven. It was, you could just sort of cancel one out with the other. And to me, like a meme I would love to try to start is, just like it would seem ridiculous to say, I'm going to smoke these two packs of cigarettes, but then I'm going to go for a 60-minute jog because jogging cancels out smoking cigarettes. We know that's not true. That's not the way the body works. But we will say, you know, I exercised for 2 hours today, so there, I can absolutely have a piece of cake, because it just, it's the antidote. And I think that that vampire myth is really somewhat at the core of this. What do you guys think?
In psychology, they actually have a term for that. It's called the halo effect. And it occurs when we do something good and see that as being enough to counteract something bad. For example, when people order a salad with a hamburger, they believe that the meal has fewer calories than the burger itself or the burger alone. Another example is when scientists noted that people who order a healthy main dish have a tendency to indulge in more sugary or fatty foods. So the same thing, the same phenomenon occurs with exercise. Once you exercise, your brain says, okay, well, it's okay for me then to have dessert, or to have a 500-calorie smoothie, or to have this big protein/energy bar that may negate any calories burned during the workout itself. What do you think, Jade?
Yeah, I love that the idea of the halo effect. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Kelly McGonigal's work. She wrote a book called The Willpower Instinct, and it kind of goes through that research and other things like that. That you know, it really is you know, important to kind of understand. And once you start really getting into that stuff, you see that a lot of this, we tend to talk about diet and exercise, and the three of us love that. But the psychology of change and that research is really, really interesting when you start getting into this. But then again, it begs the question for all three of us and our followers. I mean, essentially, we teach diet and exercise for body change. And so I guess the question is, you know, in your guys' opinion, so Jonathan, I'd ask you, I mean, in your opinion, you know, what would you say to that? If someone said, all right, well, that means, Jonathan, I don't exercise at all. What's your answer?
Well, I first like to classify exercise a bit more precisely, and I put it into three buckets. One is not exercise. It's activity. It's walking, gardening, going for a leisurely bike ride, throwing the ball with your kids or with your dog, whoever you like to play fetch with, be it canine or human. That's not exercise. That's just being active, and we should all be active, because if we're not active, our bones disintegrate and we can't function. So it's a little bit of an exaggeration there, but you get my point.
Yeah.
Then there's quote unquote exercise. So what we've all been taught, you know, in traditional literature, so jogging, things like that, that's exercise in the middle. Then there's high quality exercise or intervals or eccentric training or the metabolic effect type exercise, Jade, you talk about in your research. The first, being active, we shouldn't even need to talk about that. Of course, people are designed to move. Moving is good for you. Absolutely move. Keep doing that. The middle one, I would argue, do not do that. I do not think it is necessary. In fact, I think it causes more harm than good. The only reason I would tell someone to do it is if they enjoy it. But if they enjoy it, they should think of it as a hobby, not as something they're doing to burn fat. Like if you just enjoy jogging because it gives you joy, hey, that's good. Do it. Like have an enjoyable life. But if you're doing it for the intention of health or fat loss, your time would be better spent elsewhere. The latter category of very targeted, short duration, safe, high intensity, hormonal exercise, that is absolutely key. That is absolutely key, but it is such, in terms of the amount of time in a week, it is such a teeny tiny fraction of that time. Man, it's a small portion of the equation just from a time perspective. So all of this attention that's dedicated to exercise, I actually think it is much, much too high. That would be my opinion.
Yeah, how about you, Ray?
It's funny that you say that. There's an interesting story in John Gabriel's book, The Gabriel Method, and he talks about his cat, and I can't remember the name of the cat, but he titled the chapter after his cat, and he was telling a story about how his cat would like to, it was an outdoor cat, it would go out, it would hang outside, and his neighbor had this big, enormous dog, and the cat would kind of stroll on up to the door and kind of irritate the dog. And it would just sit there and stare as the dog was barking and going crazy. And the neighbor was getting angry. So one day, oh, and by the way, this cat, and this is important too, the cat was a very overweight cat, okay? So one day the neighbor gets so angry that the cat was bothering the dog that he opens the door and the dog takes off after the cat. And the cat runs off into the woods being chased by the dog. And for a couple of days, he doesn't see the cat. So he figures the cat kind of met its end. Well, eventually the cat comes back and it's limping and it's injured because the dog did get a hold of it, but the cat was still alive. So he takes the cat in, and what he starts to notice is that for no apparent reason, the cat starts to lose weight. It starts to get skinnier. And eventually the cat lost basically all the extra weight. And it wasn't that he wasn't giving him food. The food was there. The cat just didn't eat as much food, and the cat's metabolism was burning through the fat. So it was that one instant episode where there was this fear of death and fear of being eaten by the animal that caused the body, the chemistry of that cat to change. And so essentially that's what we're trying to do with high intensity interval training, is we're mimicking having to run away from a lion. And because of that, the body gets the signal that it wants you to be more aerodynamic, carry around less weight, so that the next time you get chased by a lion or a big dog in this circumstance, you're able to better flee and survive. So that's kind of the theory behind how high intensity interval training works. And in this situation, it took one episode, one intense episode for that cat's chemistry to change in such a way that the cat now became a lean animal.
Yeah, I really love that. And, you know, it taps right into what my opinion would be on this as well, is that, you know, hearing you two guys talk, I mean, the way I look at it is I say to myself, and actually this is summed up in a story about, you know, Africans who visited Central Park back in the 1980s for Earth Day. And they brought some, you know, I forget, Ethiopians or Africans over to, you know, some plainsmen who were, you know, essentially hunter-gatherer tribes, and brought them over to Central Park to celebrate Earth Day. And they saw these people jogging around, you know, Central Park. And they asked, you know, the interpreter, what are these people doing? And he tried to explain the concept of exercise to these people. And they burst out laughing because they could not understand the concept of just going out running, you know, for no reason. And I think when we look at it that way, when you look at the concept of aerobic exercise, it is sort of, you know, and I don't think any of us are aerobic exercise haters. I think we just try to put it in context, but it is sort of odd to think about. I mean, you know, essentially we were built for, you know, walking long periods of time, hiking up mountains, looking for food, and then short bursts of intense activity, hauling, lifting, things like that. And so when I think about exercise and, you know, all the things that we sort of preach, I tend to kind of put it in that bucket of, you know, when I think of prescribing exercise to my clients, it's do the things that we did naturally, that we're built to do, hauling, lifting, lots of walking, sort of intense bursts of activity, and then rest.
You know, there's this new term. Well, it's not really new, but it's newer in the fitness world, and that's the skinny fat. You know, we have a lot of people who are talking about how, you know, when we talked about it on our podcast, we had a lot of people who said, you know what, that's me. I'm the skinny fat. I look skinny. People think I don't have, they look at me in clothes and they think I am fine. I don't need to burn fat. I don't have to lose weight. But when I look at myself without clothes, they're, you know, they don't see what I see. And what I see is a body that looks soft, and that's the skinny fat. And that's, we have an epidemic of that in our society. If you want proof of that, just go to any beach in Florida, take a look out there, and you'll see that 9 out of 10 people are either blatantly obese, overweight, or their bodies are soft. And I'm not really talking about that from the perspective of personal character judgment. I'm talking about it from a health perspective. Healthy bodies have tone to them. Unhealthy bodies do not have tone to them. And that's what we have to consider when we're talking about the impact of various types of exercise and activity. When I've done metabolic testing in the office using indirect calorimetry, what I've discovered is that some of the people who have some of the worst metabolisms are not even the senior citizens. They're the marathon runners. They're the people that are running, you know, 6 days a week. And they have horrible metabolisms because they've basically eroded away their muscle. And guess how they describe themselves? The skinny fat.
You know, ultimately, if you want, you know, optimal body composition, if you want to get lean and tone, and you know, you might know a runner or you might be a runner who is lean and tone, and you might say, hey, what are these three guys talking about? They don't know what they're talking about. But trust me, you are in the minority. You know, you're talking to three guys who probably between them have tens of thousands of client contacts and obviously a ton of research that we've all done. And, you know, I would, you know, absolutely agree with what you guys are saying. I see, you know, runners come into my office all the time. They get on, I do skin caliper testing. I do ultrasound body comp testing. I do bioelectrical impedance testing. They always have higher body fat percents than you could imagine compared to the people who are, you know, really focusing on, you know, high quality exercise, which is the stuff we're talking about, weight training and that kind of stuff. So I think it's not a matter of saying that, you know, aerobic exercise is evil. I think what the three of us are saying, it is not the most efficient way to achieve the goals that most people are trying to achieve. And in fact, in many people, if not most, it's actually working against them. I mean, I think that's essentially what the three of us are saying. And so I think the take home here is that, you know, and you guys, you know, sort of correct me if I'm misstating what the three of us are saying, but I think what we're saying is, look, you know, we're not saying that cardio is going to kill you. What we're saying is that it's not the end all be all of heart protection. We all think it is. We're not saying cardio makes you fat, but we're certainly saying that for most people, it's not going to get you the body that you want. And so essentially what we're saying, I think, is that we have got to really, for those of you who are listening who want to, you know, change your body, you really need to change your way of approaching exercise away from aerobic exercise into more efficient types of exercise. And we're going to talk about that, you know, a little bit more tonight. But let's go into sort of the next, you know, question and see, you know, sort of what we have here. So here's a question for you guys. And this is really, you know, just to kind of give people an idea based on the conversation we're having. If we don't tend to do a ton of aerobic exercise because of what the three of us know about it, then what do we do? So, you know, Jonathan, I'd start with you. What do you do? What does a typical week look like for you in terms of your fitness regime?
The only exercise I get, to be clear, I live a very sedentary life. I'm in front of a computer the vast majority of most of my days. I exercise eccentrically once a week, generally on Saturdays. I'm sore for at least 6 days afterwards. In fact, the 48 hours following my eccentric workout, I can at times have trouble sleeping because my muscles are so exhausted. But that's all of the physical activity I do, aside from, you know, walking around.
Yeah, and give us an idea, just so they're clear, Jonathan, and even for Ray and me, especially for me, I'm curious to know what your eccentric, what's a typical day like? What does that eccentric workout look like? You know, walk us through it real quick.
Yeah, so it's generally four exercises. So one for legs, one for back, one for chest, and one for shoulders. And to be very clear, I didn't always work out this way. Back when I was a trainer, I exercised compulsively. In fact, I would actually at times exercise up to three individual times per day. So I'm talking 18 exercise sessions in a week. I'm not kidding that myself and my training partner would literally train like left bicep. Like today we're training left bicep. It was absurd. And I get better results now, and I'm training for a cumulative total. I have exercise-induced asthma, so I have to take a little additional rest between my sets. So about an hour per week. So I'll generally start with a leg press or a split squat, or at times I do deadlifts, and I practice, you know, doing eccentric techniques on that. So if it's something like a deadlift where I cannot lower more weight than I'm lifting, I will just lower the weight very, very slowly and doing more of a power explosive movement up. If it's something like a leg press or a Smith machine split squat, it's very easy for me to lower the weight with one leg and raise it with two. And that enables me to handle much more weight than I would otherwise be able to. And then I do for back, you know, either a row movement or a pull up, which is actually more like a let down, because I usually strap between 90 and 115 pounds around my waist. And we'll just try to hold the top position of a pull up for 10 seconds. And I can't. Gravity brings me down. And then I help myself back up and I repeat that. So it's not a complete absence of concentric movements. The focus, however, is on the eccentric movements. Then for chest, it's generally a press or a fly. Again, just performed eccentrically. So either going up with two arms, lowering with one, or using a fly movement down and a press movement up, because you're stronger on the press movement. And then for shoulders, I generally do eccentric handstand push-ups. So, you know, I get up in the top position of a handstand push-up, and then I slowly lower myself down. And I also do yoga because I love the flexibility. I love the injury prevention. I think we undersell those types of exercises in our culture. I think if you focus on doing strength training and then you focus on things like Pilates or yoga or these more core flexibility, other forms of fitness, I think that's such a yin and yang complementary duo. So that's pretty much my routine.
And for those of you listening, you know, you could, if you, when you listen to what Jonathan's talking about, I mean, hopefully you can get the sense of the intensity of the work he's doing. And some of you might be wondering, you know, how does that work? And part of the reason it works is because he is putting so much stress on his body during that time that his body has to then take a ton of energy to recover. And then it has to take a ton of energy to repair. And then it's going to use a ton of energy to help Jonathan adapt and get stronger, because the body knows it's going to be stressed like that again. And so you can imagine he does this, you know, very intense exercise, and then his body is reacting almost the rest of the week, it sounds like, and he is able to stay in shape. And Jonathan's a very fit guy, and that's really what it's about. So you're talking about the epitome of efficient exercise. I'm curious what you do, Ray.
Well, I walk 8 to 12 miles a day, and that would be because I own a walking desk, a tread desk. And usually you just walk 2 miles per hour, usually for about 6 hours a day, anywhere between 4 and 6, depending upon the day. And so that's kind of my foundation for the day. I do two primary strength training workouts per week. One's an upper body, one's a lower body, and they are worked probably not to the intensity of Jonathan because that style of training is extremely intense. But I do a standard split. So I do upper body push-pull activities, exercises, lower body push-pull exercises as well on a separate day. And I'll do a 4-4 cadence. So I'll do four counts up, four counts down on the exercises. And I work between 6 to 8 repetitions per set. I'll do interval training twice a week generally. Sometimes it's out on the trail. Sometimes it's on the treadmill. If I come home or if I work a little late or I have to do an emergency workout, meaning that I didn't make it out to the gym, then I'll usually go to something like Insanity, or I'll do a home kind of metabolic effect workout with some home equipment that I have here. So that's pretty much my program. I do maybe once a week, I may do what might be labeled a standard aerobic activity. I'll run a standard 5K with my intention to try to beat my previous score. I use the Nike Plus system on my iPhone, which kind of keeps track. You can do you can set for a 5K and just try to beat your score each and every time. And that's what I try to do.
Yeah, that's interesting. For me, it's really, I wake up every morning. I grab my cup of coffee and I go for an hour walk. And it is literally a slow walk, drinking coffee, talking with my wife half the time when she's there with me. And that to me gets my day started, this is not power walking. This is leisure walking, like walking your dog. I'm drinking coffee. I'm talking. 3 days a week, I do a full body, metabolic, what I call metabolic physique conditioning workout. So those of you who understand what bodybuilding is, where it's sort of this high repetition, moderate weight, and then combine that with intervals, carrying weights around. That's essentially what I do, and that workout lasts 30 minutes. So I do that 3 times a week. And then on Saturday or Sunday morning, I do 10 100-meter sprints. And that is basically a 100-meter run. Actually, it's probably about a 10-minute warm-up, 10-minute cool-down, and then 100-meter sprint, and I walk back, and that is intense enough that it takes me about 5 to 6 minutes to recover to do my next one. And sometimes I don't even get all 10 because of the intensity of that, and sometimes I'll stick with just 5 depending on how I feel. And that's pretty much my exercise for the week. Sometimes I'll go back out in the evening and do another leisure walk. So I'm sort of big on walking. And I also am, although I don't get to do it much, like Jonathan says, I do love the sort of restorative type stuff, Tai Chi, restorative yoga, not the power stuff, but sort of the restorative stretching type yoga. And I think what you can kind of take away from, hearing the three of us talk is you see, three guys, all that's, stay pretty fit, who have varying regimes that they do. But it sounds like, I always like to tell my clients, look, the best exercise program and even the best diet program is the one you love, will stick to, and can be consistent with. And so this is the program and gets you results. And so for me, it's all about being as efficient as possible. And I find that I tend to put on fat a little easier. I also put on muscle well. And this is the regime that sort of helps me maintain. Now, if I want to, get in even better shape, I don't do much different with my exercise. I instead focus on diet. So that kind of is me sort of in a nutshell. I don't know if you guys have anything more to add on that, but I do think it's interesting to go through, the three of us and our regimes.
Well, yeah, Nate, actually, real quick, Ray, I'll just say, I love hearing that we all are, we have sort of similar beliefs and research, but we all have very different exercise regimens. And I think it shows and it speaks to the fact that none of us are saying like there's this one right way to exercise, But what we are saying is there are forms of exercise that objectively have been shown to be not as effective as other forms. And it doesn't mean there's one right way or one wrong way, but it does mean if whatever you're doing is not giving you the results you would hope for, don't just keep doing it. Like, there are smarter ways and more efficient ways to exercise, and not everyone's going to respond the same way. And Jade, you communicate this so well, but don't just keep trying the same thing over and over again and expecting different results.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And what I took away from that discussion is, number one, that intensity seems to be a recurring motif in all of our programs. And I think that needs to take center stage, is when you're exercising, if your goal is to exercise, try to make those exercise sessions as intense as possible. And, you know, I have these principles. I call them the 14 guiding principles. And one of them is exercise and eat to change your hormones, not to manage calories. So we all get caught up in how many calories did I burn in this exercise session. And that is, in my book, it's a totally wrong approach to viewing exercise. What we want to know is, how is this going to impact my metabolism over the coming 24, 36 hours? And that's the key question, is what's the best exercise that's going to give me the most bang for my buck? I think these types of intense activities, it's pretty clear, are the answer, are the winner in this case.
And let me add one thing, Ray, that I love you said there, and was also came through in our conversation in terms of a common thread, and that's sustainability. So one of the reasons I exercise one day a week eccentrically is because for 7 years of my life, I trained horribly unsustainably. I was very much into athletics. I exercised just obsessively. I would be on vacation and not able to enjoy my vacation because I was so preoccupied with finding a gym so that I could go exercise, that I don't like exercise. I don't. I absolutely do not like exercising. So I have chosen an exercise routine where I can go so intense as infrequently as possible and get the results I want, because I was stupid and picked a form of exercise earlier in my life that was unsustainable, both because it burnt me out and I got injured all the time. If I wanted to go run a 5K, I couldn't, because I have no ACL nor meniscus in my right leg because of the exercise choices I made earlier in my life. So in addition to the common thread of intensity, I would also draw out the common thread of sustainability and safety. So you avoid injury, you avoid burning out, and you avoid just quitting exercise entirely.
Yeah, and you do what works too. I mean, that's the interesting thing about, you know, from what our conversations, Jonathan, you tend to be, you know, leaner just naturally anyway, correct?
That's correct. It's very difficult for me to gain muscle, but I'm generally leaner.
You know, so when I have those conversations, I love these kind of conversations, because I know from conversations with Ray, you know, he and I tend to be potentially, you know, a little bit more anabolic, in that we, you know, I gain both muscle and fat, you know, pretty easily. And so you can see that when you're thinking about the people listening who are thinking about, how do I design an exercise program for me, they have to also look at that. I mean, obviously Jonathan can hold on to his muscle and remain lean with his regime, you know, so it is about results. Let me see what else we got here.
The truth is, you put on muscle and fat easily. I just put on fat easily. So, I'm luckiest out of the bunch. And damn you, Jonathan, your skinny jeans.
Yeah. Yeah, hey, Jonathan's the one we all hate for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey, Jade, could I put a kind of a final period on this discussion?
Yeah, absolutely.
I was reading through one of the chapters of a project that you and I have been working on. And this one section I wrote a blog post on. I actually posted it on a blog post, and I'd like to read it. Read this brief blog post for you, because I think it really does drive the point home. All right, let me just read it quickly. It says, "I was editing an article that I wrote a couple of months ago when I came across a section that caught my attention. As weird as it sounds, today these paragraphs spoke to me, and I was moved. It was as if the me of 2 months ago was speaking to the me of today and giving me some tough love. I wanted to give you an excerpt from this section with hopes that you guys will be moved as well. And here it is. This is what I had in that section. It says, look, life is short. You shouldn't spend it trotting away on a treadmill. Live out loud. Enjoy the wondrous adventures that life has in store for you. Get out there and make a difference in your life and the lives of others. I know far too many people who waste their precious breath on hours and hours of elliptical machines, stair steppers, and treadmills. What a waste. Give yourself the gift of getting into the gym for 30 to 40 hardcore minutes per day. During each of these workouts, prove to yourself how much heart you have. Make them count. Leave with a sense of accomplishment, with a sense that you just proved to yourself that you're stronger than you thought. Then, after you leave your heart on the floor for those 30 to 40 minutes, depart the gym and don't look back until the next workout. You did your time. Now enjoy life. Fill the rest of your life with leisure exercise, activities that you enjoy. The key word being activities, not TV and movies. Try new things like dancing, martial arts, frisbee, hiking, yoga. Just become the person who loves to be active. That's the secret. You can't quit the habit of watching 4 hours of TV every night by just giving it up. You have to crowd it out with something more worthwhile. Become so active that you have no time to sit in front of the TV. Become so adventurous that you have stories to tell your friends and family at the next holiday party. Live in such a way that has your friends and family thinking, I want a life like that. Not because you want to be envied by them, but because you want to inspire them. Look, your life will either be an example or a warning to the people that you care about. Be the example, not the warning. And, you know, I think that spoke to me because I, like Jonathan, had that same experience. I went out there and there were times where I would spend 2 hours in the gym. I remember, you know, getting my heart rate monitor and working out for 2 hours on the treadmill. It was pure suffering. And what kind of results did I get with fat loss? None. I got no results from fat loss. And I remember scratching my head thinking, how is that even possible? You know? And I think so many people spend their lives on the treadmill, trotting away, wasting that precious lifetime that they never get back. And I think the type of information that we're given here gives them what they need to break the shackles of the treadmill, get out there and just enjoy life and be active. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I definitely know what you mean. And I think, you know, to sum it up even more, you know, based on what we all said, it's like, look, you know, just go and enjoy yourself, but, you know, do what works. You know what I mean? I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, enjoy yourself and do what works. If you're out there doing 2 hours a day of cardio and it's not working for you, you're not getting the goals you want, then you have to do something. You have to do something different. And I like the way that sort of sums things up. You know, intense exercise, get out there and move. Become an active person, you know, do the leisure activities. And I think one of the things, and this will kind of segue us into, you know, sort of this next question. One of the things we have to look at is with exercise is that the body is, you know, sort of this beautiful machine. And when you push it in one direction, it pushes back on you. And the type of exercise you do, the type of exercise you choose is going to have a direct impact on how hungry you are, what you choose to eat, the mood that you're in, the, you know, the quality of sleep you get. And that's because, as the three of us were talking about, I mean, you know, exercise is one of the prime movers of our hormonal metabolism. And of course, the other one is diet, you know, and these two things go hand in hand. And of course, one of the questions I know that you guys get, I get all the time, is how do you merge the two? So, I mean, I'm curious for you guys. I mean, so, you know, before we sort of get in what we necessarily would recommend, I mean, what do you guys eat before you exercise? Do you eat? What do you eat? How about it, Jonathan?
I'll go first. And one thing I'll note, since I hope I don't sound like the anti-exercise guy on this call, I'm like, oh, I only exercise one day a week and whatever. So some people really enjoy exercise. And to me, I just can't even imagine that. Like, I can't imagine enjoying exercise anymore. However, I would posit more precise about my eating than most people are. And in fact, I actually enjoy that. Like, I see it as a little ways I can refine what I eat. And I've always, even since I was little, I've seen food as this cool way I can change my body and change my mood on a day-to-day basis. Like, there's only so much time you can spend exercising, but you have a lot of opportunities to make choices around food consumption. So while I may be the exercise fuddy-duddy on the call, I am very, very into and excited by being a bit more precise and deliberate around what I eat. So I might not have a huge amount to add for this question because I'm only exercising one day a week. So what I eat before, during, and after exercise is not a huge issue for me. But I will just note that, you know, it's not just Jonathan has wonderful genetics. I am very, very deliberate about what I eat and have really seen, that's where I've seen my results. Like by manipulating my diet more, I've seen results that no amount of exercise has ever been able to provide to me. So anyway, sorry, I know it's a little off track, but.
No, I think that's great because what it really reinforces for everyone, and I think I know Ray would agree with this, I agree with this, is that for those listening to this call, you know, for the three of us talking, I mean, you know, to me, if you're really wanting to change your body, you can do it with, you know, very, very little exercise. I mean, just pick up walking, you know, and more, a little more activity, but get your diet right and your body's going to change. I mean, no question about it.
Yeah, you know, the research pretty much is clear that exercise has a whole lot less of an impact on your fat loss results than diet does. That's pretty clear. But what the research literature does support is the fact that that being active and performing even just conventional exercise does seem to act as one line of defense against putting that weight back on. So when we start to look at maintaining the results that we have, then exercise seems to play a little bit more of a crucial role. You know, one way we also can look at it is, you know, the more overweight you are and the more out of shape and the longer you've gone without being on any particular program, the less important exercise is. So if we were to give it a number, for example, we have somebody who's 300 pounds who's just getting started, then we could say that 95% of your situation is diet, 5% would be activity and exercise. And then as they get closer and closer to their goal weight, then exercise begins to take on more and more of an importance. And so it may move all the way up to 20% exercise, 80% diet. And so that certainly is one way of looking at it. Now going back to your question.
And Ray, to dig into that real quick, because this might be a place where we can violently agree, and that'd be great. You said the upper bound for exercise's importance is 20% of the equation. Do you intentionally mean that? Like, did you consciously say that? Like, the most exercise can matter is probably 20% of the equation.
That's right. That's accurate.
Mm-hmm. I would absolutely agree with that. The most it can contribute is 20%. Jade, what say you?
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And I think people should, you know, people listening, that's probably shocking to them to hear, because I think they see it exactly the opposite. They see it as it's 80%. Most people think it's just 80% movement and 20% what I eat. And it's not. It's the other way around. If that, I mean, and that's the thing. It's probably not even that much for most people.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I put it up on our Facebook page, the question, you know, what does it really matter? How much does it really matter? And I said probably 85-15 would be a good solid figure. Most people agree that it's about 80-20 is what a lot of our listeners had suggested. They think the link is, or the ratio. But let's say 85% diet, 80-85% diet, 15-20% exercise and activity. You know, because Jade, all this, if we're looking at the research is pretty clear. But when we actually look at it in practice, when we're focusing, and I made this mistake in the first group weight loss program that I did, is that I didn't push exercise and activity. And unfortunately, what ends up happening is people have a tendency to start to really lose muscle mass, I think, at a much faster rate than they would have if we would have started them on a weight training program right from the start. So I think it is important for a lot of people, 99% of people, to incorporate some sort of resistance training right from the start of their program, even if it's just a simple exercise program, just to maintain or hold on to that muscle mass as best they can while they're going through a weight loss program.
Yeah,
Well, I was going to say, I will second that. I believe resistance training is required, not even optional, and until you die. Like, if you're 80 years old in the nursing home, you can still resistance train. Like, resistance train is the single safest and most sustainable form of quote-unquote activity you could ever do, and I would argue that it is mandatory. It's absolutely mandatory. Everything else, optional. Well, everything else, exercise perspective, but resistance training, mandatory.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, most of the research that they, you know, one of the things that people might be interested in, I mean, the three of us read this research all the time, you know, 99.9% of the research may perhaps not that much, but it's close, is aerobic based. If we take it from, you know, all the way from today to the beginning of, you know, them doing studies on exercise, is aerobic exercise based. And so we may be having this discussion, you know, 5-10 years from now and be saying, you know, that it is, exercise is much, much more important than what we just stated, but only resistance exercise. And I think that the three of us would suspect that that is the case, you know. And so for me, when I start people out, you know, it really is walk and resistance train. And because I know from the psychology of change perspective that you don't want to change two things at once, you don't want to shake people up too much, I usually start them out with walking, but resistance training is right after that. And usually if they have their diet right, that is all they need.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. But they're also, you have to kind of give a little bit of respect to the interconnectivity of things as well. A lot of my listeners have reported, and a lot of my clients have seen this as well, that when they're on an exercise program, it, for some reason, it causes them to stick to their dietary program in a more solid fashion. Now, we may not see that phenomenon in the research because there's a lot of controls that go on in research, and oftentimes people are on a set diet anyway during those studies. You know, when we look at it in real life circumstances, it really does seem to play a role for a lot of people. Maybe not everybody, but a lot of people find that when they do their exercise program, it causes something in their brain to shift, in that they don't want to ruin what they did in their exercise program by eating a very poor diet.
Yeah, it's sort of like the reverse halo effect of what you were talking about. I mean, right. On the one hand, we're talking about the halo effect, you know, this idea that, you know, some people exercise or they tend to eat, you know, a healthy item, and then they compensate by, you know, eating something worse or ruining it. But there are other types of people who actually have what, you know, I think Ray is talking about and what I've termed the reverse halo effect. And you see this in you know, you see both of these things happening, and it tends to be certain types of people, but ultimately that's where we want to get people to. I don't know if that's what you've seen as well, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah.
Let me phrase it just slightly differently. And that's, maybe people are beginning, once you see yourself as a healthy person or a fit person, like having that self-image, I think permeates every aspect of your life. And I think the more things you do that are consistent with whatever you characterize in your mind as a healthy or fit person, you want to then be consistent to avoid another psychological term, which is cognitive dissonance. You know, if you see yourself, this is a kind of a silly example, but if you see yourself as someone who, why don't we steal? It's easy to shoplift, but we don't, because usually we see ourselves as moral people. So we avoid shoplifting. If we shoplift, we feel bad about ourselves because we experience cognitive dissonance. Same kind of thing I think we may be discussing here, where the more actions you can take which are in your mind consistent with what a healthy person does, the more you see yourself as a healthy person, and the more you get reinforced when you do these healthy activities.
Yeah, yeah, and there's other factors that come into play too. I mean, we know that exercise also increases circulation and blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, which is a very important area of the brain for willpower. So, you know, that also is another area where we're seeing some good research come out. You know, I mean, if we wanted to improve somebody's insulin sensitivity, Jade, I mean, one way we could do that is through focusing on diet, right? If we were to put somebody on a ketogenic diet and start them on a very low carb diet, it would probably take 2 or 3 days before we really start to see changes in their insulin sensitivity. That being said, we can improve insulin sensitivity almost instantaneously by getting them and doing a metabolic effect style full body, you know, resistance-based workout in 20 minutes. So I can either wait 2 to 3 days to change the insulin sensitivity, or I could change it literally in 20 minutes by doing a workout like the metabolic effect style workout, right? That's an important factor, because that also allows us to change. It allows us to map out, you know, what we eat at certain times of the day as well, because we know that exercise, and this goes to your original question, which we kind of went off on a totally different tangent. which was, what do you eat before and after workouts? And it allows us to, in certain circumstances, be able to kind of control the damage, so to speak. When we look at the ketogenic diets, when we look at Atkins-style diets, in every single study that I know of, maybe Jonathan knows of a study that where the results did last, but in practically every single study, within 1 to 2 years, everybody was off the diet. They couldn't maintain that diet. So carbohydrates on some level probably are here to stay. And so we have to kind of work with that. And exercise may prove to be one way, exercise done right may prove to be one way in which we can incorporate some of those foods and still not do a lot of damage to the metabolism, or be able to mitigate some of that damage. You think that's right, Jonathan, or do you think that there will never come a day or never come a point where that'll be possible?
Well, it's interesting. It's the type of exercise we use. So I mean, this kind of goes somewhat, listeners may be expecting me to violently disagree right now, because I made a point earlier about using exercise as sort of an excuse to do other things, and that it, at least in my research, it doesn't necessarily work that way. Depends what kind of exercise you're using. If you're using high intensity exercise, if you're using high intensity resistance training, absolutely. The hormonal changes you can cause in your body in a short amount of time can absolutely, in some ways, mitigate eating bad foods. That doesn't mean you should eat bad foods. However, it would be absurd to say that it doesn't help to mitigate them. However, to think that jogging or traditional aerobic exercise in any way gives you permission or mitigates eating insane starches and sweets, I would say that is the thing we need to throw out the window. It's smarter exercise. Yes, very, very helpful. The traditional exercise, not so much. And one other thing I'll throw out there is, well, yes, many of the sort of Atkins induction phase type diets where you're looking at less than 20 grams of carbohydrate, certainly not sustainable, but the idea, and not intended to be, right? Atkins has three phases. The third phase is much different than the first. The idea that eating a certain way or eliminating certain foods is not sustainable is not true. And many people have proven this. Like, look at vegetarians. Vegetarians do something that I personally would find nearly impossible, and that's giving up all meat. I mean, look at vegans. They give up all animal products in all contexts for the rest of their life, and they don't struggle. They don't wake up in the morning like, damn it, I wish I could eat some bacon with breakfast. They believe something, and it permeates their entire life always. They don't have cheat days where they eat steaks, and it's not a struggle for them. So I actually like to think about those types of things, or even diabetics, where if you eat certain foods, it could kill you. So miraculously, people no longer struggle to avoid those foods. So I like to think about, you know, how can we change our mindset to make it almost like being a vegetarian, but for a low quality food, so that we don't even desire them anymore. And I think that's actually more possible than some people give themselves credit for, as evidenced by people who restrict their diets for religious reasons or for moral reasons or for medical reasons. We just need to give ourselves enough reasons to make it sustainable.
Yeah. And as the culture shifts, I think that's going to be happening more as you look at sort of the cultural aspects of food. And, you know, people seeing other people, friends and family adopting these lifestyles, you'll see that sort of come more, you know, into existence. I mean, you're seeing it already with the adaptation of things like the paleo diet, you know, people doing intermittent fasting, things that probably the three of us would never be talking about, you know, back in the 1980s. And it's a lot of it is because of, you know, sort of the cultural changes and sort of new understandings. But, you know, to go back to what we were talking about before about, you know, exercise and food, I do think that, you know, it's really interesting. I would say it's both the best time and worst time to have, you know, sort of these processed junk foods and high carbohydrate or high starchy refined, you know, grain products. It's the best time and the worst time to do it around exercise. I mean, it's the best time because, like Ray said, you're mitigating some of the negative effects. It's the worst time because you're also mitigating some of the positive effects of the exercise. And so that's kind of how you want to you know, how I tend to look at that. I mean, it kind of goes to what John was saying. Yes, it'll mitigate some of the negative effects, but, you know, you're also sort of undoing the positive benefits of the exercise. And of course, different types of exercise are going to have a different effect. Moving the body in general, just going for a walk, if you had, you know, just ate a chocolate cake or something like that, is going to be better than not going for a walk. Going for a jog probably is going to have some effect as well. But obviously, I think we would say that, look, you know, what you really want to be doing is sort of intense weight-based lifting movements, and that's going to have the most beneficial impact.
Yeah, you know, Paul Cribb, Dr. Paul Cribb, is probably on the same page as us on many fronts, but he teaches that there is what he calls the metabolic window, which is this 3-hour period that occurs after exercise. And his philosophy is that as it pertains to carbs and activity, is that if it is within this 3-hour metabolic window that you can have faster absorbing, or what many would label as less fat friendly carbohydrates. Those would be things like some bread, some pastas, potatoes, and things like that, sweet potatoes, during that 3-hour period only. So the rule is no starchy carbs before exercise, and only consume starchy carbs within this 3-hour metabolic window after the fact. And he claims that in his research and in his experience, that those carbohydrates will not be transferred into the fat cells. Now, I haven't had a chance to test this out myself, but it is on my list of things to test within my own life. But it is intriguing to me. There is good evidence that there is this such thing as a metabolic window where we can change the impact of even what would be labeled as fattening foods by consuming them within a period of time close or in proximity of exercise.
Yeah, and I can give you sort of my my clinical experience with this is that I have found that absolutely to be true with myself and with people who are sort of what I would describe as metabolically flexible, you know, lean men and women who are, you know, relatively young. And I've certainly found that, even people who are metabolic syndrome or, you know, pre-diabetic doing that, you know, they don't have as negative effect. But I think we have to make the distinction, at least I have in my clinical practice, that, you know, if I have a young athletic male who is wanting to put on muscle mass and is doing, you know, heavy weight training, then, I mean, I do see that time as a free time. However, if we have, you know, someone who's overweight, you know, metabolically challenged, I have, and they obviously read these things too, you know, so we know people come in and say, hey, I heard I could have my donut or my whatever, you know, after my workout. It doesn't seem to have the same effect. Yes, it's not as detrimental, but in my clinical experience, it's not as beneficial as avoiding it as well. So I don't know if you guys have the same sort of clinical experience, but I do agree. And I think that's absolutely the case. You are uniquely insulin sensitive and uniquely able to put on muscle and burn fat, even with some of these, you know, so-called negative foods. But that happens to be in people who, in my clinical experience, tend to be lean already or metabolically efficient already, and maybe not so much of a relevant topic for those who are metabolically challenged. But I don't know if you guys see that the same way.
I would tend to agree, and I'll just add one thing, which I'm pretty sure we all agree on, and that's if your mindset is I'm going to go exercise so that I can eat garbage and not feel bad about it, that's not the right mindset to have. And
right.
Another, just to be very specific, right, we can talk about insulin and carb absorption, but we're not talking about all of the other toxic elements that are found in these types of foods, right? Like all the preservatives and chemical weirdness. And I mean, no amount of exercise is probably going to mitigate the hydroxyfluorocarbon, blah, 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 that, you know, so let's not also, I mean, many of these foods are toxic and they should not even be called food. So yes, they will do less damage. if you consume them after exercise, but please don't have the mindset of I exercise so I can ingest these toxins. That's
right. And more of what I would be speaking to, and I know that Paul Cribb would as well, is more like things like potatoes and sweet potatoes and brown rice and, you know, the actual starchy foods that I would consider what I call prime foods, which are foods that are that may be starchy, but they are almost identical to the way that they occur in nature, you know, minus the cooking aspect of it. But, you know, Jade, you and I always talk about the one core kind of belief behind both Metabolic Effect and Cut the Fat podcast. And I think it's also, the Smarter Science is Slim. It's kind of your philosophy as well. And it's this: when I was in a black belt class one day, I remember the instructor was teaching us how to defend against a knife attack. And I remember I had a question. I asked my instructor, I said, you know, when he comes at me, should I go to the left or should I go to the right here and block it this way? And he said, yes. And then he went on teaching the class. And I said, I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that. I was like, should I go left or should I go right? He said, yes. And he went back on teaching the class. I said, I'm sorry, sir, I don't understand. He says, the answer is yes, depending upon the circumstance. And in the case with whenever we're dealing with anything in fat loss, sometimes, you know, we all kind of get caught up in this is the way to do it. You know, even you and I, Jade, and Jonathan, we all kind of talk that way sometimes. But the truth is, there are some circumstances where the metabolic window concept would be 100% effective for some people. And there are circumstances where it will be totally ineffective for others. And if we start, you know, we offer these as tactics to people and ways that you can start thinking to test in your own life. I think we can all agree that no matter what the quote unquote guru says, it's not real until it's real in your own life. It's not real until you've tested it in the only weight loss study that matters. And that's the study that you run in your own life.
Yeah, I think that's just it's probably a perfect place to kind of wrap this up because we're getting into the hour. But, you know, for me, you know, the company Metabolic Effect, the acronym is ME, and it's because exactly what you're saying, Ray. It's basically saying that, look, we can talk about this stuff all day long, and the reason that it is so confusing for all of us is because it is human nature to some degree to want certainty. That's what we want. We want someone to say, do it this way. And there is nothing certain about fat loss or any of this stuff. There is too much we do not know. And we are all so very different in our metabolic expressions, in our personalities, and in our preferences. And so what I would say to people who are basically listening to the three of us talking, being like, great guys, I mean, I still do not know what to do. And the answer is exactly what Ray said. Yes. You know, and what that means is that you have to stop being the dieter and start being the detective. And I'll tell you real quick, and then I'll let Jonathan and Ray jump in and tell you guys real quick the take home for them. But here's my take home that I would say, if you're trying to figure this out, if you're trying to say, Jade, what the hell do you mean by be the detective, not the dieter? Here's essentially what I mean. Your metabolism is different. Your metabolism is speaking to you all the time. You don't need fancy lab tests and that kind of stuff. What you need is to listen to your hormonal biofeedback clues. And I call them clues because they are speaking to you just like you being the detective. And the number, there are more than three, but the three big ones that we use at Metabolic Effect are hunger, energy, and cravings. They tell you about the balance in your metabolism. The goal is to have low hunger, to have no cravings, and to have high energy, and to also be losing fat. When you get those things in line, you know that you are doing the right thing for your body, even if it is 100% different than anything Jonathan told you, or anything Ray told you, or anything I told you. That means you are getting the effect you want. Hunger, energy, and cravings with fat loss, you're doing exactly what you need to do.
Ray, do you want to go next? You?
How do you follow that piece of that work of art, Jonathan? I have a similar philosophy. I think that that's right on. You know, it all speaks to sustainability, and and how the whatever you choose works within the culture of your life. You know, I like to say there are only two reasons why you're not burning fat. Either your program sucks or your follow through sucks. And that's it. You know, fat loss is science. Fat loss, I mean, your body runs by certain laws of nature. And so there is a reason why the body stores fat. And there is a reason why the body releases fat. Just because you haven't figured out what that, you know, how to burn fat doesn't mean that that reason doesn't exist. It exists. And the only way you're going to figure it out is by, is piecemeal, is going through and following in Cut the Fat. We have a similar kind of process, Jade. We have what we call the kata formula. And it kind of speaks to, goes back to my martial arts days, where in martial arts, a kata is a series of steps that you repeat over and over again in order to learn a particular defense against an attack. With the kata in the Cut the Fat sense is spelled C-A-T-A-A, and that stands for commit, which means commit to a particular system, and then you run that system, then you assess, then you tweak, and then you assess again, and then you begin that cycle over and over again. The kata, commit to a philosophy, assess your results, tweak the program. Don't just jump ship like most people do. They jump ship and they go and find a totally new program. You just tweak the program that you have, and then you assess again. And you know, we also say that there are three things that your program, that the perfect weight loss program does. It improves body composition, it improves your health, and it improves your energy. If one of those things is missing, then your program is not finished. Your program is not perfect for you yet. It's got to achieve all three goals: improving body composition, improving health, and improving energy. And the way you put it, if you follow your hunger, your energy, and your cravings, that kind of speaks to whether or not you're achieving those things.
Yeah.
I love it. And the only thing I'll add is saying that certainly we have to custom tailor things to ourselves, but that also shouldn't leave us feeling like, well, I'm just starting from square one, because I think we would all agree, and even people pretty broadly, I mean, let's look at someone like Adkins or a Gary Taubes versus like a T. Colin Campbell and a Esselstein, where there are some, let's call them truths. And, you know, it's not, you know, penicillin does fundamentally the same thing to everybody. We're all Homo sapiens, so there are common denominators, right? The more non-starchy vegetables you consume, the more nutrition you consume, the better off you're going to be. High intensity exercise is going to be a good option for pretty much everyone. It's not going to be bad for anyone. There are these common threads: eating food rather than eating food-like products. And once you can, I think what a lot of people sometimes do is they become overwhelmed with minutia, and they tend to focus on these little components. Whereas if we look at these things, which are pretty much universally accepted, right? I don't know of anyone who says eat more sugar and you'll be healthy, or eat more white bread and you'll be healthy, or eat less vegetables and you'll be healthy, right? Like even Adkins in phase one is like, you need to eat your greens. So if we focus on these big rocks and we don't let the things that are still being worked out distract us, I think we'd be not only healthier, but also a lot happier with that sort of common denominator solidified in our mind, and then doing the personal experimentation to fill in the blanks rather than reading the newest headline or the newest article in whatever magazine and letting it just further confuse us. Like, take what's pretty much established and then experiment building off of that.
Hey, everybody, I'm back. I hope you really enjoyed that discussion as much as I enjoyed making it with Jonathan Baylor of The Smarter Science of Slim and Jade Tita of The Metabolic Effect. As I mentioned, we didn't get to everything that we wanted to get into, so we are definitely going to meet up and continue the discussion. Some of the take-home points, I think, here are, number one, intensity is key. Number two, diet first, exercise second. Number three, you have to tailor it to your lifestyle and to your body. Not all forms of exercise are going to work for everybody. Thus, you got three fitness guys. All three of us have different fitness programs. But you'll notice that within those programs, we seem to follow the same kind of rules, so to speak. And I hope that really came through in that episode. So check us out on cutthefatpodcast.com. Also, check us out on Facebook. Just search for Cut the Fat Podcast, all one word, and you'll find us there. Be sure to like the page. Also, go to iTunes and rate our podcast, hopefully with 5 stars. Leave your comments. We read every single one of them. So we'll see you at the next podcast. You guys get out there, make this happen, and remember, body change doesn't have to be a miserable experience. Make it fun. Get out there, live life, be active, eat the good foods that energize the body. And we'll see you at the next Cut the Fat Podcast.
Safe world by land.